You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
When President Trump took office earlier this year, he, like the presidents before him, got to work assembling his cabinet and the White House staff. As he named his advisors, many of them ended up being men.
But what impact could having few women in key advisory roles have on policy? And what does the lack of women in prominent roles say about the White House and how President Trump hopes to govern?
Lily Gorin joins us now. She is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University, and she recently wrote a piece for the Brookings Institution looking at the lack of women in top roles at the White House. Lily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on again today.
Well, Lily, you wrote about this recently, and you referenced how reporter David Bernstein wrote an overview about the women involved in the American Health Care Act, GOP-authored American Health Care Act, and how it seemed that women were conspicuously absent from this process. Can you talk briefly about what he had to say?
Yeah, Bernstein's article was really interesting in terms of not only talking about the fact that in the comments and in a lot of the stories about the initially defeated American Health Care Act, there were very few women who were consulted in the sort of assembling of the act itself, the piece of legislation. There are very few women who seemed to be involved in the process. And there was very little evidence in terms of, you know, when people were asked for commentary, what role did you have in any of this? There were very few women who were involved in it, and that's what Bernstein was highlighting. And also that in the next sort of phase, when there was the passage of the House sort of reform of the American Health Care Act, the photos included very few women in any of this sort of symbolic sort of pictures of the events leading up to that as well. So you have sort of the absence, according to Bernstein, of women who contributed to making the policy or writing up the legislation, and then also the symbolic photos and sort of images that we see as voters, as consumers, when we pick up a newspaper or click on a website, that there are very few women who are involved in the process, at least, you know, in terms of what we're seeing and reading.
And you have a line in there about how Bernstein points out at some point that the word chicken is used more often than the word woman as a metric of how involved women were.
Yeah, that was a kind of stunning quote that he made with regard to some of the commentary that members of the House, and there are women in the House, I believe there are 83 women in the House at the moment, that there were very few of them involved in the legislation.
And we look then at the White House maybe as a barometer of women in politics. We know that there's not gender parity in Congress. And let's look now at the Trump administration. What do we know about how the Trump administration compares to administrations that have come before it, George W. Bush, Barack Obama?
Well, the number of women in the Trump administration, there are four women who are at cabinet level posts right now: Elaine Chao, Betsy DeVos, Nikki Haley, and Linda McMahon. And that's sort of comparable to the original, I think, George W. Bush administration in terms of how many women started out and in cabinet level posts. And both the Bush administration and the Obama administration, as they continued into the second term, more women were integrated into the administration. But Barack Obama and Bill Clinton, their first cabinets had a couple more women in the cabinet than did either W. Bush's or Trump's.
How significant is that number in terms of cabinet appointments and women in key positions when it comes to the shape of policy and influence that women have on politics and on the president?
Well, I mean, it's again, including voices that have specialization. It's not just based on what your gender is, but also, you know, what experience you have, what training you have, what expertise you have. And so with fewer women who have a variety of expertise, training, education, are coming from a variety of places, those voices are absent. And that's, you know, not just in sort of the cabinet meetings or elsewhere in the Trump administration. It's across the board in terms of very few women who are on corporate company boards and so forth, so that there's you know, half the population that doesn't necessarily have or is contributing to decisions, ideas, understandings, engagement, and so forth.
And once a woman is in that inner circle or in a cabinet appointment in the Oval Office as an advisor, is she able to hold the same influence that a man would hold, particularly if she's maybe in the role of being the only woman in the room?
It's, you know, there's a lot of research that's been really interesting. Political scientists, political psychologists, communication scholars, sociologists have been looking at, you know, how we talk to one another in those kinds of settings. And oftentimes, if there's only one woman, she's often silenced, interrupted, or talked over. And we've seen some of these commentary also in social media in the last couple of weeks with regard to Senator Kamala Harris from California and some of her comments or questioning at the various public hearings of James Comey and then earlier this week of Attorney General Sessions and being interrupted by some of her Senate colleagues and also being called on cable television hysterical. And so that sort of approach and an assessment of women in conversation is very much our socialization and what women have done when they find themselves, if there's more than one, if there are two or three or four women who are at a meeting or in a boardroom, they will oftentimes, if they agree with one another, amplify one another's comments so that it's not just one woman making a comment, but it's then amplified by another woman making a similar comment or contributing a similar idea, and so that sort of idea that's often in the studies that have been done pushed aside, that idea then has more value.
Lily Gorin is with us right now. She's a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha, and she's with us to talk about why there are few women in top positions in President Trump's administration and what impact that could have on policy measures like, for instance, the American Health Care Act. And Lily, Nikki Haley, you mentioned her earlier. She's serving as the United States ambassador to the United Nations, and she was critical of President Trump during the campaign. Eventually, she did agree to join his administration. So the president, you know, could have chosen not to appoint a critic. He did. Does that speak well of his willingness to reach out to women and, I guess, to overlook certain episodes of the past?
Well, I mean, he has appointed a couple of people who have disagreed with him. And recently this week, he's also reached out to John McCain's wife, Cindy McCain, and possibly bringing her into the State Department. And John McCain has been one of the most consistent critics of President Trump and before that as candidate Trump. And so that there is some sort of potential integration of some critics of the president, either initial ones like Haley herself or by virtue of marriage, people who have been critical of him. But it's not a large percentage of his cabinet or his inner circle. Most of the people who he really surrounds himself with are people who have been supportive of him and who have been with him for a long time, not the least of them also his family members, his daughter Ivanka and his son-in-law Jared.
I'm thinking right now about Canada and Trudeau saying it was 2016 then. We're going to have equal women and men represented in government. And we saw similar effects in France with the recent election there. Is the United States behind or are those countries just ahead?
Well, it's hard to say behind or ahead, but Trudeau not only said it's not just about gender, it's also about religious diversity and diversity of backgrounds and sort of economic diversity that he brought into his cabinet. And what we see in the Trump cabinet that is interesting, and the assessment is sort of broader than just gender, but that there are fewer minorities individuals within the Trump administration than there have been since the Reagan administration. So that there is a sort of similarity among many of the folks in the Trump administration with regard to their socioeconomic background as well as their racial and gender backgrounds.
And you mentioned earlier that in the instances of Barack Obama and former President George W. Bush, that the number of women in key appointments did go up during those second terms. What is it in the second term that you think changes the dynamic sometimes?
Well, some of it is also that you bring in, a lot of the time, you bring in people in the first, particularly in the first couple of years of administration, who are on the campaign with you. And sometimes that's useful and sometimes it's not. And, you know, in the comparison to Trump, Bill Clinton's first year was really fairly rocky. And part of that was he brought a lot of folks on from the campaign who he knew from Arkansas, and again, who he trusted as people that he'd known for a long time, but they had never really operated in Washington, D.C., at least a lot of the folks. And so the difficulty is, initially, you do bring on people who you know from the campaign, who've been, you know, in the trenches with you, if you want to use that terminology, during the campaign, and you bring them on because you're also familiar with them. Oftentimes, during the course of administration, the sort of average tenure of a cabinet appointee is usually less than 4 years. So you do have turnover, and by the time you get to a second term and the end of a second term, the last 2 or 3 years of a second term, you know, there are a lot of people who came in with you that have gone on to other things, and you have other people to appoint, and they've either come through other elected offices, or, you know, they've sort of developed expertise along the way, and they become valuable members of a cabinet or staff of a president.
Lily Gorin stays with us right now. She's a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha. And we're talking today about women in politics, particularly women in top positions, cabinet positions, top advisory positions, and what impact a shortage of women or a disparity between women and men could have on politics and policy.
You could join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the lack of many women in major positions in the Donald Trump White House, or more generally in leadership positions in American politics, in Congress, in White Houses, not just Donald Trump's, in corporate leadership? Does that make a difference in terms of the success of policies, of how policies are crafted or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And right now we're continuing our conversation about women holding few key positions in President Trump's administration and about women in positions of power in politics in general. Lily Gorin is with us. She is a professor of political science and global affairs at Carroll University. She recently wrote about the topic for the Brookings Institution.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you wish there were more women playing leadership roles in the Trump administration and in American politics in general? Why do you think more women aren't in leadership positions? If you're a woman who's run for office or served in a public capacity, what was your experience like? Do you want to do more? Do you want to rise up through the ladder? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Lily, looking at that question of participation in politics, why do you think we don't see more women running for office at, you know, the local level all the way up to higher office?
Well, there's been a lot of research in political science on sort of the difference avenues between men and women running for office. And a lot of the work that's been done by some very good colleagues of mine have basically shown when women decide to run, they can raise money equally to men, and they often run, you know, strong campaigns and so forth. But there is a difference in terms of women actually stepping up as opposed to men. Men make a choice that they want to run for office, and then they move forward and they run for office. A lot of times women don't make that choice. They are urged to do it, and they have to be urged by a lot of people usually to actually step up and run for office at the state, local, or national level. And so getting women into the pipeline, both Democrats and Republicans, it's a little bit different in terms of the psychology of prompting a man versus a woman to run for office. this. And over the years, we've seen, you know, we've seen various women come up through a variety of pipelines. And I always make reference to Sarah Palin, who started out, you know, she ran for school board in Wasilla, Alaska, and that's where she got her start. And that's a lot of the time where women who end up at the national level will run for school board, or they'll run for a city council seat, something that's sort of local and something that they're involved in because of where their family is or what their family's doing, and then they'll run for higher office after that. And that's sometimes the case also with men as well. But a lot of women who do end up on the national level, that's because they've run for lower level positions before they get to a national level position.
Are there examples that we can look to internationally where there is greater participation from women in politics, about lessons that we might take to here in the United States to get more women in these higher roles?
Well, I mean, our system is also different than the parliamentary system, and that's one of the, you know, one of the differences that we've seen is that the individual woman running for office in the United States is running herself. She is going to be a Republican or a Democrat, or, you know, in Minnesota, sort of the DFL, or, you know, a third party, but they're running as an individual as opposed to necessarily running as part of a larger party in a lot of the parliamentary systems. And oftentimes the parliamentary systems, because you're part of that party, if the party comes to power, you may end up in a higher profile position than you know, just being a member of parliament, as it were. And that was, you know, as part of the way that Margaret Thatcher ended up being prime minister, was because she was part of the winning party, the Tory party. And so the difference in sort of the way that the coalitions are built in parliamentary systems oftentimes can allow for more women to rise into higher position in ways that our system does not necessarily sort of promote. And in a number of countries, there have been laws and regulations passed that the new parliament or the new ruling governmental structure will have a certain percentage of women in those positions. I don't see that happening in the United States. I find it unlikely that the Senate or the House will say that we have to have 50-50. But that is how some other countries have sort of structured themselves to integrate formally more women into positions in elected office.
That's interesting what you just said. So were you said another way? Are you saying that the American political system sort of fundamentally discourages women and maybe other diverse people from participating?
I don't know that it discourages them from participating, but there certainly aren't, you know, sort of carved out avenues that are, you know, sort of say these 50 seats are for men, these 50 seats are for women. And that is not, I don't imagine that will happen in the United States as it has been implemented in a number of parliamentary systems. That doesn't necessarily mean, again, it's detrimental for women per se in the United States, but we do have a different approach to how you get into elected office.
Lily Gorin is with us right now, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University, talking about women in politics and why currently there are so few women in key positions in President Trump's administration. And you can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Lily, going back to President Trump's current administration, he has some other women we haven't discussed advising him. He has his daughter, Ivanka Trump, and he has Kellyanne Conway. Both of them have been quite visible and at various times quite influential over the course of the past year and a half or further back in the case of his daughter. How do you measure that sort of influence?
Well, you know, again, that's sort of the influence of who the president chooses to have around him, who he pursues information or advice from, and President Trump has indicated in particular that Ivanka has a very strong voice in giving him information, in being somebody he consults. Kellyanne Conway was the first female campaign manager to win the Oval Office. And so, you know, there's a sort of historic nature to her capacity in running the Trump campaign. But her position in the Trump White House has sort of ebbed and flowed. But that's not just her. There's clearly there are a lot of the men who are surrounding Trump as well. His chief of staff Rince Priebus and Bannon, their positioning with regard to is he listening to them, is he seeking advice from them, they've all sort of ebbed and flowed. So Conway is sort of in that mix with a number of the other advisors around Trump.
We've got a comment here from Jennifer on Facebook who says, as your guest stated, there are a couple fewer women in cabinet positions in the Trump administration compared to Obama's. Is this really a big issue? 7 versus 9. Do you want women quotas? I want the best person for the job. And that's from Jennifer on Facebook. What do you say to that, Lily?
My favorite story in this regard is something that Condoleezza Rice said when she was in the W. Bush administration. And there was a discussion going on among a number of the advisors to George W. Bush with regard to pursuing advocacy to get rid of Title IX. And Condoleezza Rice had benefited from Title IX. And she stood there in the room as one of the only woman in the room, and basically said, no, you are not going to pursue this. This is a really important law that allows for women to participate in sports and with regard to understanding their role on a team and their sort of long-term ramifications of Title IX. Had her voice not been there during the W. Bush administration, and she was the National Security Advisor, she was the Secretary of State, she wasn't there in terms of understanding Title IX legislation, then the W. Bush administration would likely have pursued trying to eliminate Title IX. And I think that's one of the best sort of examples of why it's important to have women's voices at the table. They are often as well qualified as the men who are also at the table. And so I think it's not necessarily a question of quotas, but certainly a question of having women at the table participating in the discussions of policy.
Lily, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on today.
Lily Gorin is a professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Waukesha, joining us to talk about why there are fewer women in key positions in President Trump's administration. And you can join us, share your comments on the Central Time Facebook page.